Josh thought the man might have smiled, but he wasn't sure. The man said, "Welcome."
"A doctor? Can't you understand me?"
"Welcome," the man repeated, and he laughed, and Josh realized he was out of his mind. The man reached out, plunged his hands into the mud, and began to pull himself and the wagon across the road.
"Welcome,"
he shouted as he rolled away into an alley. Josh shivered, and not just from the cold. That man's eyes, they were the most awful eyes Josh had ever looked into. He got mules settled down and moving forward again. He continued to shout for help. An occasional face looked out from a doorway and then drew quickly back. Rusty's going to die, Josh feared. He's going to bleed to death, and not a single bastard in this hellhole will raise a finger to save him. Yellow smoke drifted across the road, the wagon's tires moving through puddles of human waste.
"Somebody help us!" Josh's voice was giving out. "Please, for God's sake, somebody help us!"
"Lord, what's all the yelling about?"
Startled, Josh looked toward the voice. Standing in the doorway of a decrepit shack was a black woman with long iron-gray hair. She wore a coat that had been stitched from 100 different scraps of cloth.
"I need to find a doctor. Can you help me?"
"What's wrong with you?"
Her eyes, the color of copper pennies, narrowed.
"Typhoid? The dysentery?"
"No. My friend's been hurt. He's in the back."
"Ain't no doctor in Mary's Rest. Doctor died of typhoid. Ain't nobody can help you."
"He's bleeding bad. Isn't there some place I can take him?"
"You can take him to the pit," she suggested.
She had a sharp-featured, regal face.
"About a mile or so down the road. It's where all the bodies go."
The dark face of a boy about 7 or 8 years old peeked through the doorway at her side, and she rested a hand on his shoulder.
"Ain't no place to take him but there."
"Rusty's not dead, lady," Josh snapped. "But he's sure gonna be if I don't find some help for him."
He flicked Mule's reins. The black woman let him get a few yards further down the road, and then she said,
"Hold on."
Josh reined Mule in. The woman walked down the cinder block steps in front of her shack and approached the rear of the wagon while the little boy nervously watched.
"Open this thing up," she said,
and suddenly the rear flap was unzipped, and she was face to face with Swan. The woman stepped back a pace, then took a deep breath, summoned her courage again, and looked into the wagon at the bloody white man lying under a red blanket. The white man wasn't moving.
"He's still alive?"
she asked the faceless figure.
"Yes, ma'am," Swan replied, "but he's not breathing very good."
She could make out the yes, but nothing more.
"What happened?"
"Bobcat got him," Josh said, coming around to the back of the wagon. He was shaking so much he could hardly stand.
The woman took a long, hard look at him with her piercing, copper-colored eyes.
"Damn thing had two heads."
"Yeah, lots of them out in the woods like that. Kill you for sure."
She glanced toward the house, then back at Rusty. He made a soft, moaning noise, and she could see the terrible wound on the side of his face. She let the breath leak out between her clenched teeth.
"Well, bring him on inside, then."
"Can you help him?"
"We'll find out."
She started walking toward the shack and turned back to say,
"I'm a seamstress, pretty good with a needle and catgut. Bring him on."
The shack was as grim inside as it was out, but the woman had two lanterns lit, and on the walls were hung bright pieces of cloth. At the center of the front room stood a makeshift stove constructed from parts of a washing machine, a refrigerator, and various pieces of what might have been a truck or car. A few scraps of wood burned behind a grate that was once a car's radiator grill, and the stove only provided heat within a 2 or 3 foot radius. Smoke leaked through the funnel that went up into the roof, giving the shack's interior a yellow haze. The woman's furniture, a table and 2 chairs, were crudely sawn from worm-eaten pine wood. Old newspapers covered the windows, and the wind piped through cracks in the walls. On the pine wood table were snippets of cloth, scissors, needles, and the like, and a basket held more pieces of cloth in a variety of colors and patterns.
"It ain't much," she said with a shrug, "but it's better than some has. Bring him in here."
She motioned Josh into a second smaller room, where there was an iron-framed cot and a mattress stuffed with newspapers and rags. On the floor next to the cot was a little arrangement of rags, a small patchwork pillow, and a thin blanket in which, Josh presumed, the little boy slept. In the room there were no windows, but a lantern burned with a shiny piece of tin behind it to reflect the light. An oil painting of a black Jesus on a hillside surrounded by sheep hung on a wall.
"Lay him down," the woman said. "Not on my bed, fool. On the floor."
Josh put Rusty down with his head cradled by the patchwork pillow.
"Get that jacket and sweater off him so I can see if he's still got any meat left on that arm."
Josh did as she said while Swan stood in the doorway with her head tilted way to one side so she could see. The little boy stood on the other side of the room staring at Swan. The woman picked up the lantern and put it on the floor next to Rusty. She whistled softly.
"About scraped him to the bone. Aaron, you go bring the other lamps in here. Then you fetch me the long bone needle, the ball of catgut, and a sharp pair of scissors. Hurry on now."
"Yes, Mama,"
Aaron said, and he darted past Swan.
"What's your friend's name?"
"Rusty."
"He's in a bad way. Don't know if I can stitch him up, but I'll do my best. Ain't got nothing but snow water to clean those wounds with, and you sure as hell don't want that filthy shit in an open—"
She stopped, looking at Josh's mottled hands as he took off his gloves.
"You black or white?" she asked.
"Doesn't matter anymore."
"No. Don't reckon it does."
Aaron brought the two lanterns, and she arranged them near Rusty's head while he went out again to get the other things she needed.
"You got a name?"
"Josh Hutchins. The girl's name is Swan." She nodded. Her long, delicate fingers probed the ragged edges of the wound at Rusty's shoulder.
"I'm Glory Bowen. Make my living by stitching clothes for people, but I ain't no doctor. The closest I ever come to doctoring was helping a few women have their babies. But I know about sewing cloth, dog skin, and cowhide, and maybe a person's skin ain't too much different."
Rusty's body suddenly went rigid. He opened his eyes and tried to sit up, but Josh and Glory Bowen held him down. He struggled for a minute, then seemed to realize where he was, and relaxed again.
"Josh," he asked.
"Yeah, I'm here."
"Bastard got me, didn't he? Old two-headed bastard of a bobcat. Knocked me right on my ass."
He blinked, looked up at Glory.
"Who are you?" "I'm the woman you're gonna despise in about 3 minutes," she answered calmly.
Aaron came in with a thin, sharpened splinter of bone that must have been 3 inches long, and he laid it in his mother's palm, along with a small, waxy-looking ball of catgut thread and a pair of scissors. Then he retreated to the other side of the room, his eyes moving back and forth between Swan and the others.
"What are you going to do to me?"
Rusty made out the bone needle as Glory put the end of the thread through the needle's eye and tied a tiny knot.
"What's that for?" "You'll find out soon enough."
She picked up a rag and wiped the sweat and blood from Rusty's face.
"Gonna have to do a little sewing on you. Gonna put you together just like a fine new shirt. That suit you?"
"Oh, Lord," was all Rusty could manage to say.
"We gonna have to tie you down, or are you gonna be a man about this? Don't have nothing to kill the pain.
Just
talk to me," Rusty told her.
"Okay?"
"Sure. What you want to talk about?"
She positioned the needle near the ripped flesh at Rusty's shoulder.
"How about food? Fried chicken. A big bucket full of Colonel Sanders with them hot spices. That sound good to you?"
She angled the needle in the precise direction she wanted, and then she went to work.
Can't you just smell that Kentucky fried heaven?
Rusty closed his eyes.
Yeah,
he whispered thickly.
Oh, yeah. I sure can.
Swan couldn't bear to watch Rusty in pain. She went to the front room, where she warmed herself by the makeshift stove. Aaron peeked around the corner at her, then jerked his head out of sight. She heard Rusty catch his breath, and she went to the door, opened it, and stepped outside. She climbed into the back of the wagon to get Crybaby, and then she stood rubbing Mule's neck. She was worried about Killer. How was he going to find them? And if a bobcat had hurt Rusty that badly, what might one do to Killer?
Don't you worry, Josh had said. He'll find his way.
You got a head inside there?
A small, curious voice asked beside her. Swan made out Aaron standing a few feet away.
You can talk, can't you? I heard you say something to my mama.
I can speak, she answered. I have to talk slowly, though, or you won't be able to understand me.
Oh, your head looks kind of like a big old gourd.
Swan smiled, her facial flesh pulling so tight it felt about to tear. She knew the youngster was being honest, not cruel.
I guess it does. And yes, I have a head inside here. It's just covered up. I've seen some people look like you. Mama says it's a real bad sickness. Says you get that thing and you got it your whole life. Is that so?
I don't know.
She says it ain't catching, though. Says if it was, everybody in town would have it by now. What kind of stick is that?
It's a dowsing rod.
What's that?
She explained how a dowsing rod was supposed to find water if you held the forked ends of it just right, but she'd never found any water with it. She recalled Leona Skelton's gentle voice, as if drifting through time to whisper, Crybaby's work isn't done yet, not by a far sight.
Maybe. You ain't holding it right then,
Aaron said.
I just use it like a walking stick. I don't see too well.
I reckon not. You ain't got no eyeballs.
Swan laughed and felt muscles in her face unfreeze. The wind brought a new whiff of a sickening odor of decay that Swan had noticed as soon as they'd entered Mary's Rest.
Aaron, she asked, what's that smell?
What smell?
He was used to it, she realized. Human waste and garbage lay everywhere, but this was a fouler odor.
It comes and goes, she said. The wind's carrying it. Oh, I reckon that's the pond. What's left of it, I mean. It ain't too far. Want to see?
No, Swan thought. She didn't want to get near anything so awful. But Aaron sounded eager to please, and she was curious.
All right. But we'll have to walk real slow, and don't run off and leave me, okay?
Okay,
he answered, and he promptly ran about 30 feet up a muddy alley before he turned and waited for her to catch up. Swan followed him through the narrow, filthy alleys. Many of the shacks had been burned down, people still digging shelters in the ruins. She probed ahead with Crybaby and was frightened by a skinny yellow dog that lunged out of an intersecting alley. Aaron kicked at it and ran it off. Behind a closed door, an infant wailed with hunger. Further on, Swan almost stumbled over a man lying curled up in the mud. She started to reach down and touch his shoulder, but Aaron said,
"He's a dead'un. Come on, it ain't too far."
They passed between the miserable clabbered shacks and came upon a wide field covered with gray snow. Here and there, the frozen body of a human being or an animal lay contorted on the ground.
"Come on,"
Aaron called, jumping up and down impatiently. He'd been born amid death, had seen so much of it that it was a commonplace sight. He stepped over a woman's corpse and continued down a gently sloping hill to the large pond that over the years had drawn hundreds of wanderers to the settlement of Mary's Rest.
"There 'tis,"
Aaron said when Swan reached him. He pointed.
About 100 feet away was what had indeed been a very large pond, nestled in the midst of dead trees. Swan saw that maybe an inch of yellow-green water remained right at its center, and all around was cracked, nasty-looking yellow mud. And in that mud were dozens of half-buried human and animal skeletons, as if they'd been sucked down as they tried to get the last of that contaminated water. Crows perched on the bones, waiting. Heaps of frozen human excrement and garbage lay in the mud as well, and the smell that wafted from that mess where a pond used to be turned Swan's stomach. It was as rank as an open sore or an unwashed bathroom bucket.
"This is about as close as you can stand without getting sick," Aaron said. "But I want you to see it. Ain't it a peculiar color?"
"My God," Swan was fighting the urge to throw up.
"Why doesn't somebody clean that up?"
"Clean what up?" Aaron asked.
"The pond. It wasn't always like that, was it?"
"Oh, no. I remember when that pond had water in it, real drinking water. But Mama says it just gave out. Says it couldn't last forever anyway."
Swan had to turn away from the sight. She looked back the way they'd come and could make out a solitary figure on the hill, scooping dirty snow into a bucket. Melting the gray snow for water was a slow death, but it was far better than the poisonous pond.
"I'm ready to go back now," she told him, and she started walking slowly up the hill, probing before her with Crybaby.
Once over the hill, Swan almost tripped over a body in her path. She stopped, looking down at the small form of a child. Whether it had been a boy or girl, she couldn't tell. But the child had died lying on its stomach, one hand clawing at the earth and the other frozen into a fist. She stared at those little hands, pallid and waxy against the snow.
"Why are these bodies out here?"
she asked.
"'Cause this is where they died,"
he told her, as if she was the dumbest old gourdhead in the whole world.
"This one was trying to dig something up. Roots, probably. Sometimes you can dig roots up out of the ground, and sometimes you can't. When we find them, Mama makes a soup out of them."
"Roots? What kind of roots?"
"You sure ask a lot of questions,"
he said, exasperated, and he started to walk on ahead.
"What kind of roots?"
Swan repeated, slowly but firmly.
"Corn roots, I reckon," Aaron shrugged. "Mama says there used to be a big old cornfield out here, but everything died. Ain't nothing left but a few roots, if a body's lucky enough to find 'em. Come on now, I'm cold."
Swan looked out across the barren field that lay between the shacks and the pond. Bodies lay like strange punctuation marks scrawled on a gray tablet. The vision in her eye faded in and out, and whatever was under the thick crust of growths burned and seethed. The child's white frozen hands took her attention again. Something about those hands, she thought. Something, but she didn't know what. The smell of the pond sickened her, and she followed Aaron toward the shacks again.
"Used to be a big old cornfield out here," Aaron had said. "But everything died."
She pushed snow away from the ground with Crybaby. The earth was dark and hard. If any roots remained out here, they were far beneath the crust. They were still winding their way through the alleys when Swan heard Mule neigh. There was a cry of alarm. She quickened her pace, stabbing ahead of her with the dowsing rod. When they came out of the alley next to Glory Bowen's shack, Swan heard Mule make a shrill, whickering sound that conveyed anger and fear. She tilted her head to see what was happening, and finally made it out. People in rags were swarming all over the wagon, tearing it apart. They were shredding the canvas tent to pieces and fighting over the remnants, grabbing up blankets, canned food, clothes, and rifles from the rear of the wagon and running with them.
"Stop,"
she told them, but of course they paid no attention. One of them tried to untie Mule from his harness, but the horse bucked and kicked so powerfully the scavenger was driven off. They were even trying to take the wheels off the wagon.
"Stop it!"
Swan shouted, stumbling forward. Someone collided against her, knocked her into the cold mud, and almost stepped on her. Nearby, two men were fighting in the mud over one of the blankets, and the fight ended when a third man grabbed it and scuttled away. The cabin's door opened. Josh had heard Swan's shout, and now he saw the traveling show wagon being ripped apart. Panic shook him. That was all they had in the world. A man was running with a bundle of sweaters and socks in his arms, and Josh went after him but slipped in the mud. The scavengers scattered in all directions, taking away the last of the canvas, all the food, the weapons, blankets, everything. A woman with an orange keloid covering most of her face and neck tried to strip the coat off Swan, but Swan doubled up and the woman struck at her, screaming in frustration. When Josh got to his feet, the woman ran down one of the alleys. Then they were all gone. And so were the contents of the traveling show wagon, including most of the wagon itself.
"Damn it!" Josh raged.
There was nothing left but the frame of the wagon and mule, who was still snorting and bucking.
"We're up Shit Creek now," he thought. "Nothing to eat, not even a damned sock left." "You okay?" he asked Swan, going over to help her up.
Aaron was standing beside her, and he reached out to touch her gourd of a head, but drew his hand back at the last second.
"Yes."
Her shoulder was just a little sore where she'd been struck.
I think I'm all right."
Josh gently helped Swan up and steadied her.
"They took just about everything we had," he fretted.
In the mud lay a few items that had been left behind. A dented tin cup, a tattered shawl, a worn-out boot that Rusty had planned to mend and never got around to.
"You leave things sitting out round here, they're going to get stole for show," Aaron said sagely. "Any fool knows that."
"Well," Swan said,
"maybe they need those things more than we do."
Josh's first impulse was an incredulous laugh, but he held it in check. She was right. At least they had good heavy coats and gloves, and they were wearing thick socks and sturdy boots. Some of those scavengers had been a few threads away from their Genesis suits. Except this was surely as far from the Garden of Eden as a human could fall. Swan walked around the wagon to Mule and settled the old horse down by calmly rubbing his nose. Still, he continued to make an ominous, worried rumbling.
"Better get inside," Josh told her. "Wind's picking up again."
She came toward him, then stopped when Crybaby touched something hard in the mud. She bent down carefully, groped in the mud, and came up with a dark oval mirror that someone had dropped. The magic mirror, she thought, as she straightened up again. It had been a long time since she'd peered into it. But now she wiped the mud off on the leg of her jeans and held it up before her, grasping it by the handle with the two carved masks that stared in different directions.
"What's that thing?" Aaron asked. "Can you see yourself in there?"
She could only see the faintest outline of her head and thought that indeed it did look like a swollen old gourd. She dropped her arm to her side, and as she did, something flashed in the glass. She held it up again and turned so the mirror was facing in another direction. She hunted for the flash of light, but couldn't find it. Then she shifted, turning a foot or so to the right, and caught her breath. Seemingly less than 10 feet behind her was the figure holding the glowing circle of light. Close now, very close. Swan was still not able to make out the features. She sensed, however, that something was wrong with the face. It was distorted and deformed, but not nearly like her own. She thought that the figure might be a woman, just from the way whoever it was carried herself. So close, so close. Yet Swan knew that if she turned around, there'd be nothing behind her but the shanties and alleys.
"What direction is the mirror facing?" she asked Josh.
"North," he answered. "We came in from the south that way."
He motioned in the opposite direction. "Why?" He could never understand what she saw when she looked into that thing. Whenever he asked, she would shrug her shoulders and put the mirror away. But the mirror had always reminded him of a verse his mother liked to read from the Bible. "For now we see in a glass darkly, but then face to face." The figure with the glowing ring of light had never been so close before. Sometimes it had been so far away that the light was barely a spark in the glass. She didn't know who the figure was or what the ring of light was supposed to be, but she knew it was someone and something very important. And now the woman was close, and Swan thought she must be somewhere to the north of Mary's Rest. She was about to tell Josh when the face with the leprous parchment-like flesh rose up over her left shoulder. The monstrous face filled up the whole glass, its gray-lipped mouth cracking open in a grin. One scarlet eye with an ebony pupil emerging from its forehead. A second mouth full of sharp-edged teeth opened like a slash across its cheek, and the teeth strained forward as if to bite Swan on the back of the neck. She turned so fast that the weight of her head almost spun her like a top. Behind her, the road was deserted. She lowered the mirror. She'd seen enough for one day. If what the magic mirror showed her was true, the figure bearing the ring of light was very near. But nearer still was the thing that reminded her of the devil on Leona Skelton's tarot card. Josh watched Swan as she went up the cinder block steps into Glory Bowen's shack, then looked north along the road. There was no movement but chimney smoke scattering before the wind. He regarded the wagon again and shook his head. He figured that Mule would kick the sauce out of anybody who tried to steal him, and there was nothing left to take. "That's all our food," he said, mostly to himself. "Every damned bit of it."
"Oh, I know a place you can catch some biggins," Aaron offered. "You just got to know where they are and be quick to catch them."
"Quick to catch what?"
"Rats," the boy said, as if any
fool knew that was what most of the people in Mary's Rest had been surviving on for the last few years.
"That's what we'll be eating tonight, if you're staying."
Josh swallowed thickly. But he was no stranger to the gamey taste of rat meat.
"I hope you've got salt," he said, as he followed Aaron up the steps. "I like mine real salty."
Just before he reached the door, he felt the flesh at the back of his neck tighten. He heard Mule snort and whinny, and he looked toward the road again. He had the unnerving sensation of being watched. No, more than that, of being dissected. But there was no one, no one at all. The wind whirled around him, and in it he thought he heard a squeaking sound, like the noise of wheels in need of grease. The sound was gone in an instant. The light was quickly fading, and Josh knew this was one place he wouldn't walk the alleys at night, even for a T-bone steak. He went into the shack and shut the door.
Part 10. Seeds. The hand revealed. Swan and the big dude. A decent wish. The savage prince. Fighting fire with fire.
Chapter 59. Swan awakened from a dream. She'd been running through a field of human bodies that moved like stalks of wheat before the wind. And behind her advanced the thing with the single scarlet eye, its scythe lopping off heads, arms, and legs as it sought her out. Only her head was too heavy, her feet weighed down by yellow mud, and she couldn't run fast enough. The monster was getting nearer, its scythe whistling through the air like a shriek. And suddenly, she'd fallen over a child's corpse, and she was looking at its white hands, one clawing the earth and the other clenched into a fist. She lay on the floor of Glory Bowen's shack. Embers behind the stove's grate still cast a little light and a breath of heat. She slowly sat up and leaned against the wall.
the image of the child's hands fixed in her mind. Nearby, Josh lay curled up on the floor, breathing heavily and deeply asleep. Closer to the stove, Rusty lay sleeping under a thin blanket, his head on the patchwork pillow. Glory had done a fine job of cleaning and stitching the wounds, but she'd said the next couple of days would be rough for him. It had been very kind of her to let them spend the night and share her water and a little stew. Aaron had asked Swan dozens of questions about her condition, what the land was like beyond Mary's Rest, and what all she'd seen. Glory had told Aaron to stop pestering her, but Swan wasn't bothered. The boy had a curious mind, and that was a rare thing worth encouraging. Glory told them her husband had been a Baptist minister back in Wynn, Arkansas, when the bombs hit. The radiation of Little Rock had killed a lot of people in the town, and Glory, her husband, and their infant son had joined a caravan of wanderers looking for a safe place to settle. But there were no safe places. 4 years later, they'd settled in Mary's Rest, which at that time was a thriving settlement built around the pond. There'd been no minister or church in Mary's Rest, and Glory's husband had started building a house of worship with his own hands. But then the typhoid epidemic came, Glory told them. People died by the score, and wild animals skulked in from the woods to gut the corpses. When the last of the community's stockpile of canned food gave out, people started eating rats, boiling bark, roots, leather, even the dirt itself into soup. One night the church had caught fire and Glory's husband had died trying to save it. The blackened ruins were still standing because nobody had the energy or will to build it back. She and her son had stayed alive because she was a good seamstress, and people paid her with extra food, coffee, and such to patch their clothes. That was the story of her life, Glory had said. That was how she'd gotten to be an old woman when she was barely 35. Swan listened to the sound of the roving wind. Was it bringing the answer to the magic mirror's riddle closer, she wondered, or was it blowing it further away? And quite suddenly, as the wind faltered to draw another breath, Swan heard the urgent noise of a dog barking. Her heart thudded in her chest. The barking ebbed away, was gone, then began to swell again from somewhere very near. Swan would know that bark anywhere. She started to reach over and rouse Josh to tell him that Killer had found his way, but he snorted and muttered in his sleep. She let him alone, stood up with the aid of the dowsing rod, and walked to the door. The barking faded as the wind took a different turn, but she understood what it said. "Hurry, come see what I've got to show you." She put on her coat, buttoned it up to her neck, and slipped out of the shack into the tumultuous dark. She couldn't see the terrier. Josh had unbridled Mule to let the horse fend for himself, and he'd wandered off to find shelter. The wind came back, and with it, the barking. Where was it coming from? The left, she thought. No, the right. She walked down the steps. There was no sign of Killer, and now the barking was gone, too. But she was sure it had come from the right, maybe from that alley over there, the same alley Aaron had taken her along to show her the pond. She hesitated. It was cold out here, and dark, except for the glow of a bonfire a few alleys away. Had she heard Killer's barking or not, she asked herself. It wasn't there now, just the wind shrilling through the alleys and around the shacks. The image of the child's frozen hands came to her. What was it about those hands that haunted her, she wondered. It was more than the fact that they belonged to a dead child, much, much more. She didn't know exactly when she made the decision or when she took the first step, but suddenly she was entering the alley, questing with Crybaby before her, and she was walking toward the field. Her vision blurred, her eyes stinging with pain. She went blind, but she didn't panic. She just waited it out, hoping that this wasn't the time when her sight would go and not return. It came back, and Swan kept going. She fell once over another corpse in the alley and heard an animal growling somewhere nearby, but she made it through. And then there was the field stretched before her, only faintly illuminated in the reflection of the distant bonfire. She began to walk across it, the odor of the poisonous pond thick in her nostrils, and hoped she remembered the way. The barking returned. From off to her left, she changed her direction to follow it, and she called,
"Killer, where are you?"
But the wind snatched her voice away. Step by step, Swan crossed the field. In some places, the snow was 4 or 5 inches thick, but in others, the wind had blown it away to expose the bare ground. The barking ebbed and faded, returned from a slightly different direction. Swan altered her course by a few degrees, but she couldn't see the terrier anywhere on the field. The barking stopped. So did Swan.
"Where are you?"
she called. The wind shoved at her, almost knocked her down. She looked back at Mary's Rest, could see the bonfire and a few lanterns burning in windows. It seemed a long way off, but she took one more step in the direction of the pond. Crybaby touched something on the ground right in front of her, and Swan made out the shape of the child's body. The wind shifted, the barking came again, just a whisper now from an unknown distance. It continued to fade, and just before it was gone, Swan had a strange impression that the sound no longer belonged to an old, weary dog. It had a note of youth in it, and strength, and roads yet to be traveled. The sound was gone, and Swan was alone with the corpse of the child. She bent down and looked at the hands, one clawing the earth, the other clenched into a fist. What was so familiar about that? And then she knew. It was the way she herself had planted seeds when she was a little girl, one hand digging the hole, the other. She grasped the bony fist and tried to pry it open. It resisted her, but she worked at it patiently and thought of opening a flower's petals. The hand slowly revealed what was locked in its palm. There were 6 wrinkled kernels of corn. One hand digging the hole, she thought, and the other nestling the seeds. Seeds. The child hadn't died digging for roots. The child had died trying to plant shriveled seeds. She held the kernels in her own palm. Was there untapped life in them, or were they only cold bits of nothing? Used to be a big old cornfield out here, Aaron had told her, but everything died. She thought of the apple tree bursting into new life, thought of the green seedlings in the shape of her body, thought of the flowers she had grown in dry, dusty earth a long time ago. Used to be a big old cornfield out here. Swan looked at the body again. The child had died in a strange posture. Why was the child lying on her stomach on the cold ground instead of curling up to save the last bit of warmth? She gently grasped the shoulder and tried to turn it over. There was a faint crackling noise as the ragged clothes unstuck from the ground, but the body itself was as light as a husk. And underneath the body was a small leather pouch. She picked it up with a trembling hand, opened it, and reached in with 2 fingers, but she already knew what she'd find. In the pouch were more dried kernels of corn. The child had been protecting them with body heat. She realized she would have done the same thing, and that she and the child might have had a lot in common. Here were the seeds. It was up to her to finish the job the dead child had begun. She scraped away snow and thrust her fingers into the dirt. It was hard and clayey, full of ice and sharp pebbles. She brought up a handful and worked warmth into it. Then she put 1 kernel into it and did what she had done when she planted seeds in the dust of Kansas. She gathered saliva in her mouth and spat into her handful of dirt. She rolled it into a ball kept rolling it until she felt the tingling running up through her backbone, through her arm and fingers. Then she returned the dirt to the ground, pressing it into the hole she'd scooped it from. And that was the first seed planted, but whether it would grow in this tormented earth or not, Swan didn't know. She picked up Crybaby, crawled a few feet away from the body, and clawed up another handful of dirt. Either sharp ice or a stone cut her fingers, but she hardly noticed the pain. Her mind was concentrated on the task. The pins and needles sensation was strengthening, starting to flow through her body in waves like power through humming wires. Swan crawled ahead and planted a third seed. The cold was chewing down through her clothes, stiffening her bones, but she kept on going, scraping up a handful of dirt every 2 or 3 feet and planting a single seed. In some places, the earth was frozen solid and as unyielding as granite, so she crawled on to another place, finding that the dirt cushioned beneath the snow was softer than the dirt where the covering snow had blown away. Still, her hands quickly became raw, and blood began to seep from cuts. Drops of blood mingled with the seeds and dirt as Swan continued to work, slowly and methodically, without pause. She didn't plant any seeds near the pond, but instead turned back toward Mary's Rest to lay down another row. An animal wailed off in the distant woods, a high, shrill, lonely cry. She kept her mind on her work, her bloody hands searching through the snow to find pliable dirt. The cold finally pierced her, and she had to stop and huddle up. Ice was clogging her nostrils, her eye, with its fragile vision, almost frozen shut. She lay shivering, and it occurred to her that she'd feel stronger if she could sleep for a while, just a short rest, just a few minutes, and then she'd get back to work again. Something nudged her side. She was dazed and weak, and she didn't care to lift her head to see what it was. She was nudged again, much harder this time. Swan rolled over, angled her head, and looked up. A warm breath hit her face. Mule was standing over her, as motionless as if carved from gray dappled stone. She started to lie back down again, but Mule nudged her in the shoulder with his nose. He made a deep rumbling sound, and the breath floated from his nostrils like steam from a boiler. He was not going to let her sleep, and the warm air that came from his lungs reminded her of how very cold it was, and how close she'd been to giving up. If she lay there much longer, she'd freeze. She had to get moving again, get her circulation going. Mule nudged her more firmly, and Swan sat up and said, "Okay, okay." She lifted a blood and dirt-caked hand toward his muzzle, and Mule's tongue came out to lick the tortured flesh. She started planting seeds from the leather pouch again as Mule followed along a few paces behind her, his ears pricking up and quivering at the approaching cries of animals in the woods. As the cold closed in and Swan forced herself to keep working, everything became dreamlike and hazy, as if she were laboring underwater. Every once in a while, Mule's steamy breath would warm her, and then she began to sense furtive movement in the dark all around them, drawing closer. She heard the shriek of an animal nearby, and Mule answered with a husky grumble of warning. Swan kept pushing herself on, kept scraping through the snow to grip handfuls of dirt and replace them in the earth with seeds at their centers. Every movement of her fingers was an exercise in agony, and she knew the animals were being lured from the woods by the scent of her blood. But she had to finish the job. There were still perhaps 30 or 40 kernels left in the leather pouch, and Swan was determined to get them planted. The tingling currents coursed through her bones, continuing to grow stronger, almost painful now. And as she worked in the dark, she imagined that she saw an occasional tiny burst of sparks fly from the bloody mass of her fingers. She smelled a faint burned odor, like an electric plug beginning to overheat and short-circuit. Her face beneath the mask-like crust of growths seethed with pain. When her vision would fade out, She would work for a few minutes in absolute blindness until her sight returned. She pushed herself onward, 3 or 4 feet, and one seed at a time. An animal, a bobcat, she thought it was, growled somewhere off to the left, dangerously near. She tensed for its attack, heard Mule whinny, and felt the pounding of his hooves against the earth as he galloped past her. Then the bobcat shrieked. There was the noise of turbulence in the snow, and a minute or so later, Mule's breath warmed her face again. Another animal growled a challenge, off to the right this time, and Mule whirled toward it as the bobcat leapt. Swan heard a high squeal of pain, heard Mule grunt as he was struck. Then there was the jarring of Mule's hooves against the ground, once, twice, and again. He returned to her side, and she planted another seed. She didn't know how long the attacks went on. She concentrated only on her work, and soon she came to the last 5 seeds. At the first smear of light in the east, Josh sat up in the front room of Glory Bowen's shack and realized that Swan was gone. He called the woman and her son, and together they searched the alleys of Mary's Rest. It was Aaron who ran out to the field to look, and he came back yelling for Josh and his mama to come, quick. They saw a figure lying on the ground, huddled up on its side. Pressed close to it was Mule, who lifted his head and whinnied weakly as Josh ran toward them. He almost stepped on the crushed carcass of a bobcat with an extra clawed foot growing from its side. Saw another thing that might have once been a bobcat lying nearby, but it was too mangled to tell for sure. Mule's flanks and legs were crisscrossed with gashes, and in a circle around Swan were 3 more animal carcasses, all crushed. "Swan!" Josh shouted as he reached her and dropped to his knees at her side. She didn't stir, and he took her frail body into his arms. "Wake up, honey," he said, shaking her. "Come on now, wake up." The air was bitterly cold, but Josh could feel the warmth that radiated from Mule. He shook her harder. "Swan, wake up."
"Oh, my Lord Jesus,"
Glory whispered, standing just behind Josh.
"Her hands."
Josh saw them too, and he winced. They were swollen, covered with dried black blood and dirt, the raw fingers contorted into claws. In the palm of her right hand was a leather pouch, and in her left palm was a single withered kernel of corn, mired in the dirt and blood. "Oh, God. Swan."
"Is she dead, Mama?"
Aaron asked, but Glory didn't answer. Aaron took a step forward.
"She ain't dead, mister. Pinch her and wake her up."
Josh touched her wrist. There was a weak pulse, but it wasn't much. A tear fell from the corner of his eye onto her face. Swan drew a sharp breath and slowly released it in a moan. Her body trembled as she began to come up from a place that was very dark and cold. "Swan, can you hear me?" A voice, muffled and far away, was speaking to her. She thought she recognized it. Her hands were hurting. Oh, they were hurting so much.
"Josh?"
The voice had been barely a whisper, but Josh's heart leapt.
"Yes, honey. It's Josh. You just be still now. We're going to get you to where it's warm."
He stood up with a girl in his arms and turned to the clawed-up, exhausted horse. "I'm going to find you a warm place, too. Come on, Mule." The horse struggled to his feet and began to follow. Aaron saw Swan's dousing rod lying in the snow and retrieved it. He prodded curiously at a dead bobcat with a second neck and head growing out of its belly when he ran on after Josh and his mama. Up ahead, Swan tried to open her eye. The lid was sealed shut. A viscous fluid leaked from the corner, and her eye burned so fiercely she had to bite her lip to keep from crying out. The other eye, long sealed, throbbed in its socket. She lifted a hand to touch her face, but her fingers wouldn't work. Josh heard her whisper something.
We're almost there, honey, just a few minutes more. You hang on now.
He knew she'd been very close to death out there in the open, and might still be. She spoke again, and this time he understood her. But he said,
What?
My eye,
Swan said. She was trying to speak calmly, but her voice shook.
Josh, I've gone blind.
Chapter 60. Lying on her bed of leaves, Sister sensed movement beside her. She came up from sleep and clamped her hand like a manacle on somebody's wrist. Robin Oakes was kneeling, his long brown hair full of feathers and bones, and his eyes full of light. The colors of the glass circle pulsated on his sharp-boned face. He'd opened the satchel and was trying to slip the ring out of it. They stared at each other for a few seconds, and Sister said,
No.
She put her other hand on the ring, and he let her have it.
Don't get bent out of shape, he said tersely. I didn't hurt it.
Thank God. Who said you could go rummaging around in my bag?
I wasn't rummaging, I was looking. No big deal.
Sister's bones creaked as she sat up. Murky daylight was showing through the cave's entrance. Most of the young highwaymen were still asleep, but two of the boys were skinning a couple of small carcasses, rabbits, squirrels, and another was arranging sticks to build the breakfast fire. At the rear of the cave, Hugh was sleeping near his patient, and Paul was asleep on a pallet of leaves.
This is important to me, she told Robin. You don't know how important. Just leave it alone, okay?
Screw it, he said, and he stood up. I was putting that weird thing back, and I was going to tell you about Swan and the big dude, but forget it, deadhead.
He started to walk over and check on Bucky. It took a few seconds for what the boy had said to register.
Swan? Swan and the big dude?
She hadn't told any of them about her dreamwalking, hadn't said anything about the word swan and the handprints burned into the trunk of a blossoming tree. How, then, could Robin Oakes know, unless he had gone dreamwalking, too?
Wait,
she cried out. Her voice echoed like a bell within the cavern. Both Paul and Hugh were jolted from their sleep. Most of the boys awakened at once, already reaching for their guns and spears. Robin stopped in mid-stride. She started to speak, couldn't find the words. She stood up and approached him, holding the glass circle up.
What did you see in this?
Robin glanced over at the other boys, then back to Sister, and shrugged.
You did see something, didn't you?
Her heart was pounding. The colors of the ring pulsated faster as well.
You did. You went dreamwalking, didn't you?
Dream what?
Swan, Sister said. You saw that word written on the tree, didn't you? The tree that was covered with blossoms, and you saw the handprints burned into the wood.
She held the glass in front of his face.
You did, didn't you?
Uh-uh,
he shook his head.
Not any of that stuff.
She froze, because she could see that he was telling the truth.
Please, she said, tell me what you saw.
I slipped it out of your bag about an hour ago when I woke up, he said in a quiet, respectful voice. I just wanted to hold it, just wanted to look at it. I'd never seen anything like it before, and after what happened with Bucky, well, I knew it was special.
He trailed off, was silent for a few seconds, as if mesmerized again.
I don't know what that thing is, but it makes you want to hold it and look down inside it where all those lights and colors shine. I took it out of your bag and I went over and sat down.
He motioned toward his own bed of leaves on the far side of the cave.
I wasn't going to keep it very long, but the colors started changing. They started making a picture. I don't know. I guess it sounds kind of crazy, right?
Go on.
Both Paul and Hugh were listening, and the others were paying close attention as well.
I just held it and kept watching the picture form.
kind of like one of those mosaics they used to have on the walls of the orphanage chapel. If you looked at them long enough, you could almost swear they came alive and started moving. That's what this was like, only it suddenly wasn't just a picture anymore. It was real. And I was standing on a field covered with snow. The wind was blowing and everything was kind of hazy, but damn, it was cold out there. I saw something lying on the ground. At first I thought it was a bundle of rags, but then I realized it was a person. And right next to it was a horse lying down in the snow, too. He looked sheepishly over at the listening boys, then returned his gaze to Sister. Weird, huh? What else did you see? The big dude came running across the field. He was wearing a black mask, and he passed about 6 or 7 feet right in front of me. Scared the hell out of me. And I wanted to jump back, but then he'd gone on. I swear I could even see his footprints in the snow. And I heard him yell, "Swan!" I heard that as sure as I hear my own voice right now. He sounded scared. Then he knelt down beside that person, and it looked like he was trying to wake her up. "Her? What do you mean, her?" "A girl. I think he was calling her name Swan." A girl, Sister thought. A girl named Swan. That's who the glass ring was leading them to. Sister's mind was reeling. She felt faint, had to close her eyes for a moment to keep her balance. When she opened them again, the colors of the glass circle were pulsating wildly. Paul had stood up, though he'd ceased to believe in the power of the ring before Hugh had saved the young boy. He was now almost trembling with excitement. It didn't matter anymore that he couldn't see anything in the glass. Maybe that was because he was blind and wouldn't look deeply enough. Maybe it was because he'd refused to believe in anything much beyond himself, or his mind was locked to a bitter wavelength. But if this boy had seen a vision in the glass, if he'd experienced the sensation of dreamwalking that Sister talked about, then might they be searching for someone who really was out there somewhere? "What else?" he asked Robin. "Could you see anything else?" "Well, when I was going to jump back from that big dude in the black mask, I saw something on the ground almost in front of me, some kind of animal. It was all crushed and bloody. I don't know what it was, but somebody had done a number on it." "The man in the mask," Sister said anxiously. "Did you see where he came from?" "No. Like I say, it was kind of hazy, smoky, I guess. I could smell a lot of smoke in the air, and there was another smell, a sick kind of smell. I think there might have been a couple of other people there, too, but I'm not sure." The picture started fading and drifting apart. I didn't like that sick smell, and I wanted to be back here again. Then I was sitting over there with that thing in my hands, and that was all. "Swan," Sister whispered. She looked at Paul. His eyes were wide and amazed. "We're looking for a girl named Swan." "But where do we look? I mean, my God, a field could be anywhere, 1 mile away or 100 miles. "Did you see anything else?" Sister asked the boy. "Any landmarks? A barn, a house, anything? Just a field, covered with snow in some places, and in others the snow had blown away. Like I said, it was so real, I could feel the cold. It was so real, it was spooky. And I guess that's why I let you catch me putting that thing back in your bag. I guess I wanted to tell somebody about it." "How are we supposed to find a field without landmarks?" Paul asked. "There's no way." "Excuse me." They looked over at Hugh, who was getting up with the aid of his crutch. "I'm really in the dark about all this," he said, once he'd gotten himself steadied. "But I know that what you believe you see in that glass you take to be a place that truly exists. I imagine I'm the last person in the world to understand such things, but it seems to me that if you're looking for that particular place, you might start with Mary's Rest." "Why there?" Paul asked him.
Because back in Moberly I had the opportunity to meet travelers, he replied, just as I met you and sister. I assumed travelers might show some pity for a one-legged beggar. Unfortunately, I was usually incorrect, but I remember one man who'd come through Mary's Rest. He was the one who told me the pond there had gone dry, and I remember he said the air in Mary's Rest smelled unclean.